Nashville, Tennessee. This is Keep Asking, the weekly podcast that helps you dive in a bit deeper and wider into the research providing insights into today's church and culture. I'm here today with my colleagues Scott McConnell and Casey Oliver to talk about how to plan a research project. Woohoo!
Fun stuff.
It's what we do. And actually, I probably need to repent because I always get my feelings hurt a little bit when I tell people I work in research and then they just blatantly announce in my face, that sounds boring. I'm like, it is not.
And planning a research project can be one of the funnest parts.
Right. It absolutely can, because it's when you're right in the middle of it and then you're thinking, how did I get myself in this pickle? You know, Scott, great news. You get a freebie today. So that's the good news. Today, I want us to glean some insight from Casey, who who just bought a car recently, and he really did a very commendable job on his research. And you know, that's saying something for me to say that. And in preparing for the purchase, Casey, what are three takeaways that you had from kind of walking through that and, you know, making the magic tie from that kind of research to the research we do?
I think one thing was just to prioritize, what do I actually need and want out of this car and what don't I need? Because I think you could wind up talking yourself into paying for things that you're never going to use I need the bigger van because if we wind up having two more kids and then somebody else needs a ride and like you're like, oh, well, actually, this is a far-fetched scenario where we're then, how do you prioritize the things that, okay, these are actual essentials, things that are important for us. Mm-hmm. We don't need the Bluetooth through the, the hands-free Bluetooth thing. Right. I'm not talking on the phone very much and Mary Beth certainly wouldn't be while she's driving with our kids. So, just kind of knowing what's actually important to us. That was one. A second thing would be being patient and not settling, both in terms of searching, because you go on a website and once you know those priorities, you can sort of be specific in the criteria you're looking for and say, hey, I'm looking for under this price with under this miles and this type of car. And you see a list of 10 of them and maybe all of them aren't exactly what you're looking for or cost a little more than you were hoping for or but one, that's not the only website that exists. There are other ones and you can go check on those as well. And also, cars are coming and going at various times too. So, not just jumping at like, well, I guess if I have to pick between these six cars that I'm looking at right now, I guess I'd have to buy this one. But being able to be patient and finding one that you're really excited about.
How did you know when you had that saturation point of I really know what's out there now?
I think probably I just overanalyzed the heck out of it. Okay. I think that's kind of the way that I do things.
Right, that's true.
At some point, though, if you feel like, I've seen some big gaps here and this is on the lower end and now as I'm searching, I can't find anything that's really, much less expensive than this. And that if I do, then I'm seeing some red flags in terms of it looks like it's been an accident or different, had six owners or whatever mm-hmm. it is, So I think, and then at some point being aware that, my time's worth something too. So if I've researched and I've found, here's two or three cars that I feel pretty good about, if I wait another 6 months to do something, at some point that stops being patient and that's being like, well, now I'm costing myself time and, time with the car and time continuing to search for it.
Right.
So being patient there in the search process and then also negotiating. Lizette came and helped me with that. So that was helpful.
I'm so excited. So I think that ties in. Mm-hmm. That's a little foreshadowing when we talk about when to bring in an expert later on in the podcast. I don't know if that's exactly how it is.
But yeah, Lizette, and that's actually, that was kind of going to be my third thing too, is trust the expert. So not just Lizette in terms of her expertise in negotiating and you want to tell them about your background in that?
I'm familiar with negotiating. It may involve new and used vehicles. We'll leave it alone.
Okay, that's fine. And then also, you can get into this place of, okay, well, how do I know that it's not just going to fall apart afterwards? And, I'm buying this thing and maybe it's priced well because of, and you start filling in the blanks with terrible things. And so just, I brought it in for a pre-purchase inspection. It costs like $60 to do that. And, things that they found, you know, that $60 payment versus, okay, finding out later, oh, there are things that I didn't account for that I wasn't really paying attention to or knowing to look for even, and then having that go poorly. So yeah, it's sort of investing in finding somebody's opinion who knows more than I do to start with. You know?
Right. Mm-hmm. So kind of checking out the landscape, trusting the expert, being patient, mm-hmm. and kind of working a process. So we really could wrap the podcast.
I tried to set this up so that extensions.
Well, and I think it's important because research is a process that we all do. You know, when you're trying to either, we may do it well or we may not. Let me be clear. We, as in Scott Casey and I, do research well. But, you know, if we're researching a vacation, researching a new product, we all do it to learn, to move forward. And it's more than just collecting. And I read this. I don't know if it's from a researcher, a guy who writes about the process, but Cresswell or somebody. But it's not just about collecting the information everybody else has gathered and rearranging it. It's collecting it and making a decision and acting on it, or letting that information shape more information that gets acted on. Any other thoughts, Scott, before we start breaking down the process and maybe why we decided, hey, let's do this topic?
No, let's jump in.
All right. So who's involved when the, you know, we're thinking of the researcher, you know, that can be us or, you know, the person I think kind of the person I had in mind when we were discussing this was, you know, the doctoral student who has a project that they're working on. And so that's kind of who I have in my mind. Scott, I know that when we talked, who do you have in your mind as we walk through this process? We have two different people, you know, kind of as we think of that.
You know, somebody at a ministry where they have some decisions to make and they need some information to help inform that. So, you know, either them or the doctoral students kind of starting that conversation of, so what would this project even look like and how do we get what we actually need?
Right. And so part of the whole, I think the tension that we're going to hit, we're not necessarily building up to, but how much do you do on your own? And then, you know, how much do you take on? But then almost, and that's the whole scope of the project and the level of expertise that's needed. So some things about the who that I was thinking of, it can be the researcher. When I'm thinking of the doctoral student, they can have a need, they can have a project, they can have an assignment. Or like you mentioned, it can be someone trying to solve a problem for someone else and they've been given the research task. But a key part in thinking about who is who's going to use the findings, who cares about the problem. Those are just some questions I had. And the difference between fulfilling curiosity and gathering usable data and information. Casey, any thoughts on when you hear about, when you're hearing proposals or thoughts about a research project and you're like, that's just not even interesting.
Interesting,
right. But may not be helpful.
Yeah, and I think that's a question we're driving at, you know, a lot of times as we're helping craft these projects and, you know, is like, how are you going to use this information? And not just from a, oh, this sounds interesting, or even it could be a talking point or whatever, but also, you know, is the question set up in such a way as to help, you know, have meaningful data analysis on the back end of it? And, you know, that can be a hard question to answer sometimes, but that's an important question to be asking beforehand.
Scott, I know we've had lots of conversations on the doctoral students and the tendency and the temptation to take just this trajectory that's kind of way off from everything else that's out there. What would you say to a D-min or a PhD student who is going to do maybe mixed methods or quantitative? Any thoughts on helping them think about building on existing research and, you know, contributing to the conversation versus let's just go?
Yeah, I think as a student's approaching it, the question they need to ask is what is the one thing that I can add to the scholarship in this area? And, you know, pretty much any major work, a dissertation type level work, they're going to need to do that background research to see what has already been done. And so from that, they need to be thinking, what's the one thing I can add to this? I may take somebody else's, you know, hypothesis or future research idea and actually test it. I might be the one exploring, setting somebody else up to come back behind me and test it. But what's the one thing I can add? And, you know, in a business setting, in a ministry setting, it's not that different. I think, you know, there the past scholarship, you know, isn't published papers in most cases, but it's other research that's been done. Mm-hmm. It's internal metrics that you have and, you know, the feedback that you're getting in your normal feedback loops. And you're trying to say, I need to add something to that to make this decision I've got coming up or a series of decisions. And I don't feel like my current set of data is enough. So what's the one thing, what's the main thing that I need to know to really get to the point of making a good decision?
One of the ways I've tried to help folks in any kind of project to kind of combine who the research is going to matter to, that's, you know, whose problem does it solve and who are they helping with the research. But if the main point of the project was summarized in a blog post, you know, who would read it? Who would benefit from it? Who would care? I told Becca Stoneking, she works here now, but a fellow student at Southeastern Seminary. And, you know, it's not about all the great possibilities in that full scope. It's the, if you could write an angry blog post and tell someone four things, you know, of, because at that point, when you think of the angry blog post, and not that we all need to be angry, but at that, it's so much easier to think, oh, this is the stream. These are the, you know, you can say the no, apparently I can't say philosophies. But then you're jumping in and saying, okay, in here, these are the places where there's problems, where we have a gap in knowledge, that kind of thing. And who would care and who wouldn't care? Because sometimes it's, you know, can you say, I will hear people talk about something and it's maybe their pet pony, but you're like, nobody cares. I mean, that's not anybody's problem. Or, or the other thing is, are you sure they don't already know this? I'm amazed sometimes at the breadth, you know, of someone's like, I want to study the impact of mentorship on discipleship. And you're like, that's a long way to go to narrow that scope, you know, and it's a worthwhile exercise, but there's a lot to do. Casey, when we're working on projects, you know, when we're talking to folks, there's always the question of how much stuff do they need to find out, you know, how many people should be, you know, if they're going to be a survey, how many questions should be asked. I know we deal with it because we want, if you think of 10 good questions, then there's 15 questions you've left on the cutting room floor. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's always that, well, if I want more people to answer more questions. So how do you balance that with maybe what are the pressure points, I would say, that sure. that are influencing those decisions?
I mean, some of them are just really practical constraints, you know, that, okay, you can't pay for or afford this, you know,
right,
extremely long research project potentially. Another one I think is just at some point survey takers start giving less helpful information or, you know, there's a survey fatigue that happens mm-hmm. if they're taking a survey and they're like, now I'm on minute 45 of this thing. And,
right.
you know, you can feel like, okay, they're just trying to plow through at that point. They're not really contemplating and giving you deep answers somewhere along the way. So I think those are a couple of them. But I also think just kind of, you know, did we ask something that's like almost the exact same thing a few times already? You know, sometimes we can say like they feel like maybe I'm putting a little bit different spin on this. And if you'd say, okay, how would I use this information as opposed to the question that you wrote right here? That's probably the exact same way. You know, if that's the case, then, you know, there's no need to ask both of them if it's the same question, just worded slightly differently. And I think also just leaving some room for, you know, for, you know, whatever they're, okay, hey, you know, we can do, we want to do this 20 question study, you know, well, five of those hopefully then are going to be, you know, kind of demographic type questions to allow you sort of not just to go as wide, but also maybe deep in terms of, you know, where are the distinctions and who's answering different ways. And that those can be some of the most meaningful subpoints to sometimes some of those stories that we look at, is not just here's the main thrust of public opinion on something, but then, well, how do Christians feel? How do people with evangelical beliefs feel? How do different people of different ethnicities feel? All those different questions can wind up kind of giving you a much greater depth to understanding the variety of viewpoints out there.
A couple of quick questions for you. One, imagine you were explaining to an 8-year-old how many people you need to fill out the survey. When is it okay for 70 people, and when do you need 1,000? And, you know, just remember, you're picturing an 8-year-old.
Sure.
And then what? Why does it matter?
Well, so in one sense, more is always better. There's no point at which you're like, oh, we asked too many people. You know, so that's great if you can easily ask 1,000 people, that's great, you know, and ask, you know, get those 1,000 people instead of those 70 people. There is diminishing returns the more and more people that you're asking. And so even though you asked me not to, like, I'm going to give like a little aside here where I'm talking something.
We're running out of time.
All right. So I'm processing this within the framework of a margin of error. That was my sub
okay, gotcha.
There. So, right. But yeah, so the more people you're asking initially, you're narrowing that down and saying, hey, this is what we think it is, but it might be 6% more than this thing we're after, or 6% less than this. And you ask, you know, a couple hundred more people, and it's like, no, now we think it's, you know, 4% more than this, or 4% less than this. You ask a couple hundred more people, 3% more, 3% less.
I feel like you're losing the 8-year-old.
So I'm just saying, I'm saying the more people you ask, the closer you get, yep, to being confident that you're near the truth, but the further, you know, once you say from 3,000 to 5,000, there are diminishing returns to that in terms of saying, okay, well, now I'm a little bit more sure, but I'm not really that much more sure than I was at 3. I'm already pretty confident that I'm, you know, within 2% or whatever of the actual number I was interested in.
Now, I did think, and this just may be me, I think I came up with a really good clarifying thing. Say your 8-year-old wanted to survey kids on the playground who wanted to play football, you know, trying to figure out how many they needed. But it wouldn't be beneficial to survey kids that don't go to his or her school, mm-hmm, because that's not the sample. It's not relevant.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, in addition to, I guess I was thinking mostly just in terms of the how many, but right, in terms right of the who, it's important too. You know, you're aiming for some population of interest that you're trying to explain, okay, for these people. So you want to be grabbing specifically from those people. Sometimes when we do surveys, we're actually screening to get to that, you know, because we might not be able to start with exactly the group, you know, we might not be able to have a list that says, here's the people that we want to be asking this question to. But as we go through the survey, you can have questions that screen to get to that point of, here's the people who are really interested in asking this question to. Yeah.
Casey, you had a great point when we were talking about this a few weeks ago. When should you bring in an expert? What was your pithy?
Yeah. So I think I said the right time to bring in an expert is not after data collection. You know, at that point, you've crafted a survey, you've maybe asked some questions you shouldn't have asked it, or in a way that you can't really draw any real conclusions from, and then you hand somebody your mess and say, hey, can you clean this up for me? And the answer normally is probably not much. You know, there's not that much you can really do with after you've already collected all the data. You know, I can't, if you didn't ask the right people, if you didn't ask the right questions, you know, at that point, I can tell you what percentage said this thing to this thing you shouldn't have asked to begin with, but that's not that helpful, you know. So bringing people in on the front end where they can be thinking about, well, how is this going to translate to a statistical analysis, or how is this going to translate to being able to have meaningful findings afterwards? Just, you know, in the same way that for my car, it's not, I didn't want to buy the car and then bring it in and say, hey, tell me everything that's wrong with this. You know, that would be bad. That's not right. A great, because then you find out afterwards and it's, you know, it's too late to undo what you've already done.
So in some respects, on the front end, you don't do the steps, but you have to think through the steps, mm-hmm, of what information do we actually need and how will I analyze it?
Yeah.
Because if you're going to plan a certain type of analysis at the end, you've got to ask the question in the right way at the beginning to be able to validly even do that analysis.
Yeah.
I'm really excited about the illustration I came up with as I was planning. Y'all can be honest, but I was thinking in terms of whether or not to bring someone in is what do you need the final product to inform? You know, what's the weight or the significance of the decision making that's going to happen on with that? And the example I thought of is sewing your own clothes. You know, if you take it on all yourself, but you really need a full outfit, you're putting yourself through all these hoops of learning all these new skills that you're not going to repeat. They're not something you're regularly going to do.
And is this a new hobby of yours?
No, it is not. No. I promise. No, my mom tried to teach me how to sew once. And when she told me to pull the threads out with a little thread puller, I was like, this is awful. And that was the end of my sewing.
At the end of it, you still probably didn't do as good a job as if you had, you know. And it might still look ugly, even though you tried really hard.
Right.
You know, for me, that's how it would happen, because I can't imagine even thinking for a second, like, oh, I'm going to start trying to do this.
But if you need to make some curtains, sew a pillowcase, you know, that kind of thing. All right, guys, any final thoughts before we wrap up? Well, thanks for listening, everyone. If you have any questions, please tweet to us at SMacon, at StatsGuyCasey, and at Lizette Beard, or at Lifeway Research. Get the word out far and wide about the research podcast changing the world. Join us next time for another edition of Keep Asking. Keep asking, learn more, do better.